From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. In a rare move on Friday, the United States made the decision not to veto a United Nations Security Council resolution calling for an end to Israeli settlement construction. Secretary of State John Kerry earlier today laid out a vision for future peace between Israelis and Palestinians.
The vote in the United Nations was about preserving the two-state solution. That's what we were standing up for.
Meanwhile, on Twitter this morning, President-elect Trump urged Israel to stay strong, adding that January 20th is fast approaching. We'll get the latest. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. The United Nations passed a resolution Friday denouncing Israeli settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, describing them as a major obstacle to peace between Israel and its Palestinian neighbors. In a break from longstanding policy, the United States decided not to veto the measure, prompting Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to accuse President Obama of orchestrating the resolution. We're going to bring you the latest on rising tensions between the Obama administration and Israel, and with President-elect Trump's recent choice of a pro-settlement hardliner as America's next ambassador to Israel, we'll also discuss what a Trump presidency might mean for U.S.-Israel relations. We want to go first across the Atlantic and welcome Sebastian Usher, who is Middle East editor for the BBC World Service, who is with us from London this morning. And Sebastian, good to have you back with us on Forum. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Let me begin, if I may, with you by just getting a sense of a response to, I don't know if you had an opportunity to hear Secretary of State Kerry this morning. He just finished a speech he delivered, but he said a two-state solution is the only really way, and it has to be preserved, and essentially offered that as, call it a defense, call it an explanation or clarity on why the United States abstained.
Yes. I mean, this has been a – I mean, I've listened to quite a lot of it. I mean, he's still talking. This is a very impassioned and personal speech. I mean, he said at the start of it that the decision that the U.S. took last week not to veto the resolution was in accordance with American values and in accordance with what other administrations have done in the past. I mean, he's very much making the point that – the U.S. remains the friend of Israel, but the friend of an Israel that needs to live up to its ideal of democracy. I mean, he has suggested that the way that Israel has been going with the hardliners, I mean, these are not his exact words, but the sense being that as it becomes more hardline, the less its chances of actually fulfilling its potential, fulfilling the ideals, as I say, that the U.S. has shared for so long, and the reason why he's suggesting that the U.S. has stood by Israel for so long. I mean, what we're seeing really is the strongest expression of all the tensions there have been between the Obama administration, between Mr. Kerry and the current Israeli leadership, and also the current mood in much of Israel politically over the past few years. I mean, Mr. Kerry, back in 2014, tried, but soon after he took the post as Secretary of State, tried to do what has eluded everyone else in his position and every U.S. president, to have a deal between the Israelis and the Palestinians. 9 months was spent, a lot of political capital from the Obama administration was spent on this. And in the end, despite all those efforts, nothing came of it. And I think Mr. Kerry has kind of had this speech in his back pocket ever since. I think some people would say, the ones who feel that a lot of what he's saying makes a great deal of sense about the two-state solution, the warm words, in a sense, he's used about the Palestinians. Now, I mean, obviously, he has alluded to the fact that no acts of terrorism can possibly be justified, just as that was part of a UN resolution last week. But he's spoken about, you know, the plight of Palestinians and the way that if a one-state were to result rather than the two-state solution that's generally been accepted for some time now, the Palestinians would have no way out of this, and that Israel, if it's to be a democracy, should not be responsible for such a situation. So, you know, I feel that in a sense, for people who side with what he's saying, I would hazard a sense that they feel that he's saying it too late. This is at the end of his administration. It's at a time when the peace process really shows no sign of going anywhere. This is almost a cry of anguish at where we've got, saying that unless, you know, things have changed now, it could be too late. And obviously this is in the shadow, as far as Mr. Kerry would see it, of the Trump administration taking over next month. And they very clearly, from what Mr. Trump has tweeted, from a move that had been made, as you said in your introduction about the appointment of the new ambassador, seemed to be much closer to Mr. Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel's vision of where Israel should be going, than what Mr. Kerry and Mr. Obama have been trying to push.
Actually, the new ambassador, I think, could be correctly characterized as being to the right of Mr. Netanyahu. And also, Mr. Trump said we cannot, President-elect Trump said we cannot continue to let Israel be treated with such total disdain and disrespect and stand strong Israel and all of the rest of that. But I'm wondering what your take is and how you interpret the anger that's come from Israel. Prime Minister Netanyahu has actually talked about limiting relations with those 12 nations who supported this. And he's also essentially blamed the White House and said that they engineered things, that the Department of State and the White House and Samantha Power were really behind completely crafting this. And allegations and charges are going back and forth. Some have actually said that it was the British who were behind.
We have a piece in one of our leading newspapers today, The Guardian, which makes that case quite strongly. Working with the U.S. administration to get the wording right on the resolution. I think it's a sense, you know, really of betrayal in Israel, the sense that, you know, the U.S. has always looked out for their interest at the most important moments in the U.N. It's always stepped in and stopped the resolutions that could put Israel seriously on the back foot, and it didn't this time. And that is basically it. I mean, it's not surprising that there is huge anger that's being directed and personal anger that's being directed by the Israeli leadership at the Obama administration, at Mr. Kerry himself, because they have felt that the US has always been there for them, no matter what the tensions. And there have been many, many tensions, as you're saying you're going to discuss in more detail, between, particularly personally, between Mr. Obama and Mr. Netanyahu. I mean, there have been times when Mr. Netanyahu has appeared to snub the U.S. president.
And many are interpreting this as a way of President Obama, as he goes out of office, getting back at Prime Minister Netanyahu. I know we only have a couple more minutes with you, Sebastian, so I want to get you on record about the settlements themselves, because more than 500,000 Jews are living in about 140 settlements that have been built since Israel's 1967 occupation of the West Bank and East Jerusalem. And what I'm wondering is, will this have any effect? Because Israel has postponed a vote to authorize construction of almost 500 new homes in Jewish settlements in occupied East Jerusalem.
Well, they have framed that as being an intervention by Benjamin Netanyahu ahead of his speech by Mr. Kerry. They don't want to inflame the situation any further by having this literally as he's about to speak. And already it was clear that he was going to be speaking very, very strongly. So they didn't want to make that even worse. I mean, obviously, Israel relies on America financially and in a political context, whatever may have happened last week. And that hasn't changed, and that isn't going to change. It's the extent of that that is at stake. And what President Obama and Mr. Kerry have done here is to show their absolute disavowal of the way that Israel and the peace process, which can hardly be called that, has drifted in the past two or three years. But as I say, this is a last-minute attempt. Now, the UN, that resolution is there. It cannot be gone back on. There is talk that what Mr. Kerry says today may lead to another resolution in the UN before Mr. Trump takes office. But I think this will be seen, as I say, by many who are sympathetic with what the Obama administration is now saying, that it is too little and it's too late from that perspective. But from the Israeli a sense. They want to be reassured as soon as possible, and as Donald Trump has done on Twitter and in other comments that have been made and other moves that have been made, that there will be no change in that relationship. And in fact, there will be a reversal of what President Obama has now done. I don't think that's necessarily going to change the momentum that's built up in the UN from that vote. I mean, that's what, in the end, Israel's most concerned about. But the relationship between the US and Israel, which is so central to Israel's position and its power in the region, I don't think that is going to be changed. And I don't think that if President Obama had another 4 years in office, to be honest, despite this rhetoric, that would change that much either.
Sebastian Usher with us again from London this morning, Middle East Director for the BBC World Service. Appreciate very much your being with us. Thank you.
And let me thank you. Thank you very much.
Tell you who is joining us for the rest of this hour here in studio. George Bisharat is Professor Emeritus of Law at UC Hastings College of the Law, former legal consultant to the Palestinian Legislative Council. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let me also say good morning to Abraham Sofer, who is Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. He was legal advisor to the United States Department of State and principal negotiator of the Taba Accord between Egypt and Israel. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thank you both for being here. And George Bisharat, let me begin with you. This has been characterized as a major diplomatic victory for Palestinians, and I suppose it is from most standards of looking at it. But we've also heard that Mahmoud Abbas hopes for an opening of a Mideast conference in France, actually coming up January 15th. Is this going to lead to the possibility, do you think, of actually having negotiations?
Unlikely. Yeah, I think Israel's position at this point is that it is not interested in negotiations under these kinds of conditions, and I think the likelihood of any progress being made is virtually nil.
Abraham Sofer, see it that way?
Well, the fear is that there's a plan to pass a resolution confirming that there's a Palestinian state. It's a more complicated resolution than this would be, and the French have been in favor of that. I think basically they tried to write such a resolution, but they realized that they would be putting stuff in there that require the Palestinians to do things. And this is a fundamental problem. Palestinians aren't willing even to speak until Israel ceases every part of its settlement project. Maybe they've given up on that, but the Israelis are still concerned that that's what the plan is in Paris.
I wonder, George Bisharat, what you say to the argument that this will I'll ask you just plainly, do you think that Israel will be taken to the International Criminal Court as a result of this? That's what many are suggesting.
It could certainly lead in that direction. It's very clear that settlements are illegal under international law. Israel's own legal advisors in 1967, the very distinguished international jurist Theodore Meron, at the time that he was an advisor to the Israeli Foreign Ministry, told his government in 1967 that settlements would be illegal. Every other legal authority that has ever considered the matter, from the International Committee of the Red Cross to the International Court of Justice, the Security Council, the General Assembly, every government in the world except Israel holds that the settlements are illegal, and under the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, grave war crimes, this being one of them, are criminal acts which are punishable under the Rome Statute. And the Office of the Prosecutor is currently undertaking a preliminary investigation into possible war crimes in the occupied Palestinian territories that would include the possibility of the settlements. So I do think there is a substantial possibility, enhanced, I would say, by this resolution, encouraged by this resolution, that things could go in that direction.
And Abe Sofer, in fact, the argument that this is in violation, settlements are in violation of international law, in fact, the language is flagrant violation for the United Nations.
Yeah, it's never been done before. It's complete fraud that was perpetrated in the UN when they claimed that this was consistent with U.S. policy. The U.S. has never voted to call the settlements a flagrant international law violation.
But they also argue that the settlements have no legal validity.
Yeah. There's a big stress on the legal argument. And, Ronald Reagan said the settlements were legal, but he also said it's unwise. And the emphasis of any good diplomat who's trying to solve a problem, and he has a party that's really honestly interested in solving that problem, would be to look at the problem and try to solve it, not to start escalating the legal arguments about it. And that's been the policy of every president, virtually every president, including this one. He vetoed the resolution in 2011, very similar resolution to this one, because he thought it was not constructive to be stressing the legal thing. And, you know, Chapter 6 says that the way to do this, resolve any difference, is to go to the International Court of Justice. And I would expect that there'll be all kinds of actions now that by anti-Israel people, anti-Israel groups, anti-Israel states.
You feel that this will, justify like the boycotts and trade restricting and outright acts? Perhaps,
absolutely. We'll escalate that. They'll try to arrest Israeli officials in foreign countries. They're going to just escalate the problem rather than try to solve it. And that's the reason why they vetoed the 2011 resolution. And they've given up, basically. And they wanted to teach Netanyahu a lesson and basically kicked him in the face. And this was a way of doing it because, as Ben Rhodes said, he had plenty of opportunities to avoid this date. That's what they have basically said outright, that if Israel had only taken their opportunities to listen to what Kerry was telling them, this would never have happened. It's just a way of saying.
You should mention that Ben Rhodes is with the New York Times and actually did say he was deputy national security advisor also and denies that the Americans were involved in crafting this resolution and the like. But let me go back to you, George Bershirat. There is a concern that this abstention by the United States will tend to or work toward the sort of things that Abraham Sofer just touched on, you know, justifying boycotts and trade restrictions, but also perhaps even terror and delegitimize Israel.
Well, look, I agree with Abe to the extent that this is not simply or perhaps even primarily an abstract international legal matter. This really involves the lives and the livelihoods of Palestinians who are trying to live in their homes that they've lived in for decades, if not centuries, till the fields that they've tilled since time immemorial, to tend the olive groves that they have planted and intended for decades, if not centuries. And the settlement enterprise involves the taking of their lands without compensation, theft in simple terms, and the exclusion of them from their properties and the giving of those properties to Jewish settlement on purely racial grounds. Palestinians don't get to keep their lands because they're Palestinians. Jews get to live in those lands because they're Jews. This is a purely racialized system of colonial takeover and settlement. Now, and it has real human impact. And the reason why Palestinians have insisted that this stop is because of this human impact that it's having on the Palestinians. As a friend of mine characterized it long time ago, if you're negotiating over how to share a pizza, and one side is eating the pizza while you're negotiating, you know, what's the point of the negotiation? That's exactly what has happened over now more than 20 years of negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians. The number of settlers in the occupied territories has more than tripled in this period of bilateral negotiations, which have really functioned as a charade or as a facade behind which the colonial advance has
continued.
Doesn't
this also boil down to concern about what is going to be greater Israel? I mean, Israel sees East Jerusalem not as something that's going to be part of a Palestinian state, but as part of Jerusalem.
Sure, it does. Israelis, current politicians are more outright and frank about their ambitions for the complete takeover of what they call Judea and Samaria, or the West Bank, as everybody else calls it. And yes, this is the way that they believe that they can realize their vision of a greater Israel. It is, of course, an apartheid version of greater Israel, in which Jews enjoy special privileges and Palestinians have no political rights whatsoever.
And we have to add here, I think, Abe Sofer, that Prime Minister Netanyahu has said he favors a two-state solution. But in terms of sort of acting on behalf of especially, I think a lot of, and let me just get your take on this, a lot of the concern about moving out of settlements has to do with what happened in Gaza. He moved out of Gaza and as a result, Hamas and even more terror. Isn't that a real factor in the calculus?
It's a real factor. But keep in mind here that most Israelis are opposed to most settlements, the settlements over over on the West
Bank.
The
polls certainly reveal that, but yeah, the polls also reveal that the Israelis and the Palestinians both want peace.
Well, yeah, and they've been exactly. So how do you do that? This resolution really sets back the two-state possibility because it's, first of all, it's going to push everyone to the right in Israel. It's going to get people very angry, as you've seen already. And Trump is going to come in to try to reverse this and to push it the other way. I don't think this resolution is going to help that situation. The two-state solution is the right solution, in my view. And settlements are not helpful. I mean, the American government has never felt settlements were helpful. They complicate the situation of a withdrawal, as you said, in Gaza. But they have never prevented Israel from implementing a withdrawal when it had to do it. When the Egyptians came, first of all, till 67, settlements were not a problem because the Palestinians wanted to drive, and the Arabs wanted to drive Israel out of Israel entirely. Israel was whole, it was a settlement. But after 67, this settlement project was a big mistake. A lot of people feel that it was a mistake. Now, in 73, when they had the war, and then Egypt came to the negotiating table, they negotiated over the settlements in the Sinai. And Israel withdrew from all the settlements in Sinai. It was a very traumatic thing. 7,000 settlers were taken, many of them screaming, etc. They gave up the oil fields that they had developed. They gave up the military installation they had to develop. So they were willing to accept peace and give up all the settlements. And they did that again on a minor scale with Jordan. And then they did it again in the withdrawal from Gaza, where they gave up 21 settlements, 10,000 settlers, many of them screaming. You saw the television. It was very traumatic. Some of them had been there 30 years. They had built these businesses. All the businesses were surrendered. And then Clinton negotiated a settlement where Barack offered to give up 97% of the West Bank, including all the settlements other than the ones
Ehud
around
Barak,
Jerusalem.
The former, Prime Minister.
The Prime Minister, yeah, exactly. And then that happened again with in the next administration where they offered 94% of the West Bank. The fact of the matter is that settlements are an obstacle to peace in the sense that they make it more difficult for Israel. I don't know why they do this to themselves.
And the Secretary of State, Kerry, said today, this has to be the only way. I mean, he made that very clear. That is, dismantling the settlements as part of a two-state solution. I would say Prime Minister Netanyahu is definitely between a rock and a hard place here. I'd like to hear from you, our listeners. If you have questions or comments, please feel free to lend your voice to this discussion we're having. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Again, your call's welcome at 866-733-6786 or join us by email, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. We do want to hear from you and get you involved in this. We're continuing with George Bisharat, who is a former legal consultant to the Palestinian Legislative Council, and Abe Sofer, legal advisor, U.S. Department of State, formerly. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The United Nations passed a resolution on Friday denouncing Israeli settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, describing them as a major obstacle to peace between Israel and its Palestinian neighbors. And in a break from longstanding policy, the U.S. decided not to veto the measure, prompting Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to accuse President Obama of orchestrating the vote. Israel's government indicated Monday it plans to move ahead with hundreds of new homes in East Jerusalem, but that has essentially been, to some extent, put aside for now. And President and Secretary of State Kerry spoke earlier today about this issue, and we're bringing you the latest and discussing what a Trump presidency means for the resolution. I'm looking at a question from a listener here, which definitely deserves to be grappled with. Why does Trump want his bankruptcy lawyer to be ambassador to Israel? That's a very good question. This is someone who, as I said, that is David Friedman, the ambassador named by Trump, who is very far to the right and very pro-settlement, who has called, for example, people in J Street who want to have the settlements dismantled, who are nevertheless pro-Israel, being like the capos, you know, who are aiding the Nazis, using that kind of language, and not being real Jews. Let me read some comments here. Edith writes, as an American Jew, I support Secretary Kerry and President Obama's efforts to a two-state solution in Israel. I am disgusted with Trump and his ambassador nominee catering to Jewish settlement extremists. I think military aid should be cut off as long as Netanyahu is prime minister. His policies are inhumane toward Palestinians. Netanyahu does not want peace with the Palestinians. On the other hand, here's Rick, who writes, Israel should never give up the land they conquered after being attacked by Palestinians and their helpers. This land is legally their land. To cede this land would be suicide. The Palestinians have shown by decades of terrorist activity, as well as the destruction of Gaza, that they cannot be trusted at this point. And more of your comments here, just to give you an idea of how polarized this issue is, if you had no notion of that. Mike says, stop apartheid in Israel, incorporate the West Bank, and let the Palestinians vote. Ben writes, as an American Jew with relatives in Israel who are pro-settlement, I fully support the U.S. using its influence to stop the settlements. The Israeli right is way too powerful and dangerous to Israel, and I believe Jews everywhere. And another tweet from Anne Marie, who says the settler movement is inhumane. And by the way, again, you can add your voice to this by calling us at our toll-free number when a line becomes available. It's 866-733-6786. And let's go to your calls. Let's go first to Mark. Mark, you're on. Morning.
Yes, morning. I'd just like to state that I think that this is a good opportunity for the United States to have taken to bring to the world view, in fact, that these settlements are, in fact, a detriment. But the question I wanted to raise to your guest is, in fact, because there's going to be a new administration, does this really give Netanyahu the opportunity to slam Obama like he really wanted to do for a number of years? Because he definitely does not see eye to eye with the president.
Well, like, hear you on this, Abe Sofer, because this morning Secretary Kerry said no one has been a bigger supporter of Israel than the Obama administration. He made the case, particularly in terms of money and armaments.
Yeah, I think the military support has been very steady. But the very ideological approach to the peace process, he never referred to the Bush letter, which basically took care of the settlement issue, a large part of the settlement issue, the same way Clinton had. And that is to say that the settlements right around Jerusalem, the major settlements, which contain about 80% of all settlers, would be part of Israel in exchange for a land transfer. He left that out of his Cairo speech entirely. He condemned all settlements equally. And he basically made it impossible for any Palestinian leader to go back to where Arafat had been, which was to accept that proposition. That was not one of the parameters that led to the collapse of the Camp David II talks. So Obama set this thing back hugely, no matter what his posture is, that he's a friend of Israel. The fact is, he had an idea. All settlements are illegal, and you leave it up to the parties to figure that out. But the fact of the matter is, the U.S. had gone down the road of distinguishing between the big settlements that contain 80% of the settlers and all the other settlements. And this was a huge setback for the peace process because it fundamentally caused the Palestinian leaders to insist on no less than Obama had insisted on. And it caused Jewish leaders in Israel to say, can we trust America? Here he is. George W. Bush thanked Sharon for withdrawing from Gaza, and he made this representation that the U.S. recognized that these big settlements around Jerusalem would likely be part of Israel, as Arafat had as well. And he just decimated the peace process. So whatever his personal motivations were, he was Obama. He says, he comes out and he says he's going to do all these things with everybody and kumbaya. But the fact of the matter is, he doesn't settle anything with anyone, and he does things unilaterally.
Let's
and
hear
that's
from
what
George
he did here.
On this, George Beshara.
Well, I admire and respect President Obama greatly. I've met him personally. I'm fond of him. I have to say that not only his, but all other American administration stewardship of the Middle East peace process has been a disaster, his and everyone else's.
Do you think, as the caller was suggesting, though, that perhaps there was intention here of on Netanyahu's part of really socking it to Obama, so to speak? I mean, well, we can't really detect that or even surmise that, but yeah, that seems to be in many people's minds what happened.
That's a possibility, but in the larger frame, I don't think the personal disputes between two particular leaders are really what drive the show. If it were that, then I think we would have seen appreciable differences between the American president's supports over time. Basically, what we have done is we have provided relative degrees of support for Israel, either complete and totally unconditional or somewhat equivocal as under President Obama. But we have always acted, as Aaron David Miller famously said, as Israel's lawyer in this entire process. We have never been an even-handed broker. Polling in the United States consistently shows that a strong majority of Americans prefer that we be even-handed in our dealings in the Middle East, and we never have been. So that's really at the root of the problem, whether it's President Obama or President Bush or President Clinton before him or President Bush before that or any of the other presidents.
Of course, Secretary Kerry was talking today about the special friendship between the United States and Israel, and that's often vaunted as, you know, being at the core of what you're talking about here, that is support
sure.
for Israel, because both democracies and have always had a long time alliance and so forth. But let me bring in more of our callers. And Trish, let's go to you. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to make the comment that if Israel really wanted to do the right thing, each time they build settlements, they should build 25% to 30% of them for the Palestinians.
Okay. We'll let that stand. Thank you for the call. We'll go to more of your calls, and you can join us at 866-733-6786 or by email, forum@kqed.org, or on our website, kqed.org/forum. Here's Damien. Damien, welcome. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for having the show. I just want to reiterate what some of the callers have said, that it was about time that the United States actually voted, maybe or not vote, to encourage Israeli settlements, which I know one of your speakers says not a big deal. It is the deal. It is a way to encroach land and then have to bargain afterwards about getting rid of the land. They shouldn't take it in the first place, so they won't create the situation. But my question is this. What if Israel continues, like they've threatened, even though they put it aside, to continue building settlements in defiance of the resolution? Will the UN treat Israel like they treated Iraq, Iran, and other nations that have violated UN resolutions? Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for the question. Let's go to Abe Sofer.
Well, right now the UN has acted under Chapter 6. Of the Charter, and that doesn't provide for the sanctions that Chapter 7 provides. So that wouldn't happen right away, nor is it likely that a Trump administration would allow sanctions to be imposed on Israel. But the point is a good point, I mean, in the sense that if you go down this road of legalizing everything and of having these kind of formal declarations, you're going to have a lot of energy and a lot of nastiness emerge on the legal issue, attacking each other, arresting people, boycotts. You know, basically the Jews of Israel feel that Europe has put a yellow star on all Israeli commerce. And that, you know, they feel that it's all anti-Semitic. And we may feel, hey, look, these settlements are just a complication. And the way to deal with it, of course, is the practical way to deal with it. I had the honor, you know, of doing the last settlement, the last hotel in Sinai and getting it back to Egypt. And I thought we were very even-handed. We had an arbitration. We encouraged the Israelis to do what the arbitrator said they should do, and the Israelis did it. It took time. It took effort. But I think the U.S. actually is very neutral in this posture. They really do want to bring about peace. We do. The United States, our State Department, wants to bring about peace. And this is the fact that we haven't gone down this UN road is because, as our UN ambassador conceded in her speech, the UN is not a place to put Israel. Israel is not treated fairly at the UN.
Well, Israel doesn't trust the United Nations.
25 General Assembly resolutions a year.
That's been very clear by things that Netanyahu has said. But I want to get to a comment here and go to George Bisharat on this. It's from a listener. I'm not sure how to pronounce the name, T-E-A-H. But he or she asks, why don't you ask this simple question? Will the Palestinians, including Hamas and Hezbollah, guarantee Israel's right to exist or not? That has to be the first question. The settlements are there for Israel to be able to defend itself. Israel cannot defend itself without the West Bank. If Israel's right to exist is guaranteed, then they can give up the West Bank.
Well, so Hezbollah, of course, is a Lebanese party,
not a Palestinian party.
Yeah. The PLO, which is recognized as the sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people, recognized Israel and its right to exist in 1988 in Palestine National Council resolutions. It reaffirmed that when it signed the Camp David Accords in 1993. So that's already a done deal. From the legitimate legal representative of the Palestinian people, the PLO, of course, has not included Hamas. Hamas has its own perspective, but it has also indicated its willingness to accept the existence of Israel within its pre-1967 borders, in a what it characterizes as a long-term truce, which many people see as a face-saving way of agreeing basically to a two-state solution. So, but with the settlements, no. It's impossible for the Palestinians to construct a state that is viable, in which people can travel freely and conduct commerce and visit their doctors and go to school and do all of the things that people do in normal daily life when their lands are ridden with Jewish-only settlements, apartheid settlements, which have their own roads, their own infrastructure that cut through Palestinian land and over which Palestinians or, you know, cause Palestinians to have to travel around them or under them or over them. Or, you know, it makes life impossible. So it is impossible to have any solution that does not involve the substantial withdrawal of Israeli settlements.
And we'll go to more of your calls. We go to Henry next. Henry, thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Yes, Michael. I think if you just step back and look at this very simply and forget all the stuff that's happened over, you know, 20, 25 years, whatever, I mean, this whole problem stems from the way Israel was set up originally, as is the case with so many land reorganizations that are done by the bigger powers after wars or during colonization. And then Israel was legitimized, and we supported them regardless of what they did through all kinds of presidents and all kinds of ups and downs. But at the end of the day, the Israel folks in Israel just didn't really, really want to negotiate in good faith and used all kinds of tactics to stall getting, you know, to try to get what they wanted, which was more land. And so it's what I don't understand, and I'd like to hear a comment about, is why the U.S. felt it was in their interest to support this over such a long period, when obviously our position and support for Israel was causing so much trouble for us with other Middle Eastern countries, and for these countries legitimize their anti-American feelings, and just has generated wars and all kinds of chaos at a huge expense, probably trillions of dollars. And essentially, we're doing this, accepting this for 500,000 people that are living in, 200 square miles. I mean, it just doesn't seem like, I don't understand why the U.S. has felt this was in their interest to be, you know, such a good friend of Israel, you know, when they were completely intransigent.
Yeah, Henry, thank you for that. And again, I'll defer here to Abraham Sofer. I mean, you even have expressed your concern about the settlements. So why the support? How can you justify it?
Well, this is a hugely overstated position on the part of the caller. Israel has been attacked repeatedly. Israel has not attacked anyone. There's been war after war. There was a resolution dividing the territory into a Jewish state and an Arab state. The Arabs rejected that. I mean, we don't need to go through the history, you'd think. But, of course, this caller's complete ignorance requires one to recall that this has not been a situation where Israel has been attacking the Arabs. The Arabs have been attacking Israel. Israelis are fundamentally believe that the Palestinians are insincere about peace. They did make the declaration George says here that they made, which is good, and which I supported. And, you know, I was in the administration when we recognized the PLO. I was all for it, and I am for it, and I am for negotiating. But the fact of the matter is, terror continues. Even Abbas gets up and he praises the martyrs who killed some children, who stabbed some Jewish family. And maybe the Jewish family shouldn't be in that little isolated settlement in the West Bank. Maybe everyone should agree to that. That's rational. But still, why would you murder them? Helpless civilian children and women and families. And then why would you, as the leader of the Palestinian people, praise the murderer?
Of course, the irony is that from most perspectives, Abbas has been most pragmatic and perhaps more reasonable, certainly, than any Palestinian leader extant. Wondering, George Beshra, I mean, Abbas is getting up there in age, too. I mean, is anybody likely to succeed him? And would somebody who succeeded him want to move the process forward?
I think the internal Palestinian political scene doesn't show a great deal of hope, sadly. And I think that it is an important agenda item for Palestinians themselves to generate a more democratic and more representative leadership that steadfastly stands up for their interests. And I think that that from the standpoint of most Palestinians, this leadership has fallen far short. Now, not in the ways necessarily that other people believe they have fallen short. I think most Palestinians believe that this government has been this Palestinian government has been compliant and far too concessionary, far too willing to make concessions to go along with Israeli plans and not resist them as steadfastly and as creatively and imaginatively as possible. And I think that change is long overdue. But to go back to your caller's question about U.S. support, I think there's a complex set of reasons that we have supported Israel, including in its settlement enterprise. And that has to do with a range of interests in this country that include certainly the pro-Israel lobby, the arms industry, which generally has benefited from our relationship with Israel, and Christian evangelism. These are three significant political forces in the society that have definite interests that are served by U.S. support for Israel. And unfortunately, there's not an organized constituency on the other side that really stands up for broad American interests. And that's why there has always been a significant disjuncture between For a long time, there has been a significant disjuncture between the general American public opinion, which I cited earlier as saying, 65% or so of Americans think we should be even-handed and don't believe that we are currently even-handed in our dealings in the Middle East. There's actually a significant number of people, nearly it's about 47% of Americans, according to recent Brookings polling, show that they support either sanctions against Israel or stronger actions against Israel to stop its settlement enterprise. There's this huge disjuncture between what the American people believe and what its political class does. And it's because there is no organized constituency to balance those of the highly organized and highly effective trio that I mentioned
earlier. Yeah, I'm just reflecting for a moment on what kind of effect the abstaining is going to have I mean, the American Jewish vote is significant. They're small in number, but they're significant because so many of them vote, and they have long been overwhelmingly, disproportionately Democrats and in support of Democratic candidates. And there was slight shift with Trump, and one has to wonder where this is going to go. But I'm also wondering, George, if you can respond to a question from a listener named Kathy who writes, the guest was cut off who said twice that Israel offered to give up 95% of settlements. Why did the Palestinians reject? What is their role in this? If the Palestinians control East Jerusalem, will they control Israel's ability to go to the Western Wall?
Well, there's a lot of mythology about what has occurred in these various settlement offers. So I believe Abe earlier was referring to the 2000 Camp David negotiations, in which it was claimed subsequently that most of the West Bank was offered by Israel, to be returned to the Palestinians. That there was never a document in writing in which that was stated clearly. And the Palestinians never really had a chance to respond to a clear and definite offer. That was just pure mythology. That was spin that occurred after. And I don't know if anyone recalls at this point, but prior to the negotiations, President Arafat of the Palestinian president of the Palestinian Authority, chairman of the PLO, had pleaded not to conduct the negotiations because he didn't believe that the technical requirements had really been fulfilled. And many of these details had not been worked out. So, you know, the Palestinians supposedly rejected a generous offer. There never was a generous offer.
This is two completely, of course, opposite narratives, as everything else is when you probe into and look into this situation. Because we had Ambassador Dennis Ross on, and as I'm sure you know, he wrote a book that says things very contrary to what you just described. But let me bring some more callers into this. And,
well, not just him. Clinton, many people have written books about that and said things that said that there was an offer. And they did take care of things like Jerusalem, for example. The fact is that—
Again, I just have to add, these are two conflicting narratives, and to some extent, I don't know what it serves. But let me get some more callers on here. David, go ahead. You're on.
Yes. Good morning. excuse me. I'm an atheist Jew, and I've got one question for BB and the boys, and it goes like this. I'm just wondering how well they could adapt to the conditions in which the Palestinians are treated if they had to live like that themselves. And on the settlements, if I remember correctly, Rabin was against the settlements, if my memory serves me correct.
It's probably why he was assassinated.
Yeah, well, probably why, yeah, exactly. So, I'm very much against the Zionists, and I really regret the report right now in Whitefish, Montana, where this Richard Spencer's mother lives, who is an absolute anti-Semite, is now calling, and they're going to have a 200-person gathering on January 20th, and they're advocating violence against the Jews as we speak right now. And I can tell you this, I don't see where the Zionists are helping us Jews all around this world.
All right. I'm going to let your statement stand, David, and thank you for that call. This is going on in Whitefish now. It's getting certainly some press. I want to get to more of your calls, though, and I want to actually go to a comment here. Ted writes, we cannot support the move to a one-state solution. Netanyahu has clearly signaled a new policy where the two occupied territories evolve into two reservations for Palestinians. Under this policy, West Bank and Gaza Palestinians will never have the full rights of citizenship of any country. On the other hand, here's Roberto, who says, Besharat does not mention that Abbas has repeatedly stated that no Jews will be allowed on Palestinian land. Is that true, George?
I have not heard such reports. No, he may very well have said that no settlements may, you know, be allowed to remain in Palestinian territories, but he has never stated that Palestinians would or that Jews would not be permitted in Palestine.
What about what Abe was bringing up before?
I have read that. Maybe the sources are wrong, but I've read that he said explicitly, no Jew will be allowed to live in Arab land. And as an Arab Jew myself,
we got two different narratives.
We've been through 800,000 Jews in Arab lands were expelled, basically, because Israel was created. So it didn't surprise me. It disappointed me enormously. Obviously, I think Jews should be allowed to live in what we hope will be Palestine, and Arabs should be allowed to live in full freedom and citizenship in Israel as they do today.
Let me read a couple more listener comments, and this one is almost devoid of hope. Richard writes, such a tempest over nothing. The resolution accomplishes nothing. Netanyahu will continue to thumb his nose at the United Nations and world opinion, probably even the Israeli Supreme Court. Trump and his advisors will support Israel no matter what it does. Billions of dollars will continue to flow from the USA to Israel. More settlements will continue to be built. Somebody, and here's a tweet from another listener. It says, make the boundaries, institute two states, Jerusalem goes to the UN, done. makes it sound pretty easy, doesn't he? But as you two gentlemen have once again shown, it is not easy. And I also appreciate the civility with which you carry on this debate. If only it could continue along those lines throughout the region. Thank you for being with us. Thanks to Abe Sofer, again, who is senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and was legal advisor to the U.S. Department of State and principal negotiator of the Taba Accord between Egypt and Israel. And thanks to George Bisharat, professor emeritus of law at UC Hastings College of the Law, former legal consultant to the Palestinian Legislative Council. We also had Sebastian Usher with us, earlier Middle East editor for the BBC World Service. And we'll have David Thompson with us in the hour coming up. He's written a book about television, so we will decidedly be shifting gears. We do, however, want to tell you that we appreciate your listenership and are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour will be repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. And you can continue this discussion online. In fact, encourage you to do that by simply going to our website, kqed.org/forum. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg, and Jeremy Siegel, with help from Maxine Sheffer-Wolf. Engineer is Katie McMurrin. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Amanda Font. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Joanne Wallace. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.